Well, we picked up on Robert Putnam's work years ago in this program. His book, Bowling Alone, documented how American society was losing its social capital. The question, of course, is how do we begin building it back up? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The last time we visited this topic, we found out that there are many efforts to restore our civic common ground, and it takes work. Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, and Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, email talk at APRN.org. Today, we meet some artists who are walking the talk on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
And how? Hello, friends. This is Steve Heimel, and I'm going to have fun for the next hour, and hopefully you will, too. The telephone number, 1-800-478-TALK, if you're in Anchorage. It's a local call at 550-8422. I had one person advise me last week, would you slow down when you give out the phone number? I'll try. I'll just keep repeating it. Essentially, as I said in the introduction, I have artists. I've got 3 artists joining the program, and I want each of them to have a chance to at least do a little presenting because artists do create things. And I think where I will start is with Marion Call, finally done with her 50-tour state. Marion, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve.
50-state tour.
Yes, yes.
So, you are a musician.
Yes, sir.
And a poet.
Yes, sir.
And you have succeeded in using the internet and social networking and all that to essentially, A, promote yourself as an artist.
Yes.
And B, arrange and execute a tour of all 50 states.
Yes, sir. That's right.
Yes,
and to and one of my favorite parts of the internet entering the equation is that it makes it possible for me to do that and continue to live in Anchorage, which is where I want to live. And I think that before social networking, that probably would not have been possible. In fact, there's a good piece in Alaska Dispatch just this morning about the fact that we can finally really start having an indie music scene here in town instead of exporting all our musicians outside. Because once you reach a certain point of playing in this town, you saturate your audience and you can't make any more money and you can't sell any more records and you can't afford to tour because it's too expensive to get out. But internet music sales have changed that and internet music tour planning have changed that. And so now we have a number of bands who are actively looking to be full-time bands or full-time working musicians who have decided that they want to keep living here. And I hope that's possible. I want to keep living here, and I want to keep touring outside and keep selling music. But the internet's made it possible for me to have my community of choice.
I remember the last time this happened, we sort of became a Seattle North. We became a sort of a northern branch office of the grunge sound with a heavy metal edge.
Was that a good thing or a bad thing?
It was a good thing.
We had some great bands come out. some fantastic bands come out of here back then.
Yeah, it was a good thing. But the thing is, do you think this time there will be an Alaska sound?
I think there may already be an Alaska sound. We have some bands here who I guess fusion is sort of the thing right now, right? Every genre has sort of been played out, but interesting fusions are definitely what people are interested in right now, and really one of the only directions to go. And we have some fantastic fusion that's come out of
how
out
could
of Alaska.
We not look at Bamiyo for Pete's sake?
Yeah, Bamiyo is amazing. I try and explain to people a native Alaskan funk band that sounds kind of like Earth, Wind, and Fire mixed with these incredible chants in a number of native Alaskan languages or native circumpolar languages. And and people don't, and I have a very hard time explaining it to people until I play Bamiyo for them. But they've won a Grammy, right? Or they've played at the Grammys and they've won the Nammies.
Yeah, right.
And
Nammies,
and then we have bands like the Whipsaws, which to me is a sound that they did very, very well and outside and may again hopefully. But their sound reminded me. I used to talk with friends about how their sound was like, you know, the sound of kids growing up in the bush or in rural-ish Alaska and listening to Pearl Jam and Nirvana, but with only banjos and guitars at their availability. And this is the music they create, you know? And I think that's fantastic.
I'm loving it already. We're talking with Mary and Colin. I want to get back to you and to this issue of community and social capital and all that, and because you've seen the cool place, the places that would have you in all 50 states, and I'm sure you've seen some contrasts, and I want you to talk about that. But first, I want to introduce our other guests. I think I will now go by telephone to Haines, where longtime public radio commentator and now book author and columnist Heather Lendy is with us, and her latest book is Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs, to be out in paperback in a couple of days. Heather, it's a privilege to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks, Steve. It's nice to be here.
Heather, I'm so glad that I get to see you every year because you're doing your MFA and you come in at to the university. This is going to be your last year of that. But anyone who has read your book, and your books, is aware that you have really taken the art of writing obituaries to some kind of new level. And it's just amazing. And this is almost the definition of a community. It's an obituary properly written is more about the living part of the community than the part of the community that left.
Oh, yeah. And I think it also is part of the community's history. And then, you know, when you're writing it as well, you realize all the connections. You know, just reading the survive bys, it's like, oh, wow, they were related to them and them and them, and that's why, you know. And I think that properly noting people's passing in a community does connect us.
Yeah. So you do this. This is another one of your things that you do in the town, along with being on the radio from time to time and finishing up a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still do the column?
Yeah, actually, right.
And
currently
a blog.
I'm a contributing editor to Women's Day at the moment, and I'm doing a monthly column for them.
Wow. So, and also you're writing the obituaries for the paper.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah. First and foremost, probably, you know, and that's kind of what I do in my town.
Yeah. So you got any work on that this week?
No, we actually, though, just had, last week, we had a longtime librarian, Ellen Borders, who was one of our librarians here for 31 years, kind of died suddenly of a heart attack, and so I got to write her obituary, which was, sad and also enlightening, I think, to realize how much someone who helped us pick books had an influence over our community, and it ties sort of right in what you're talking about with creativity. I mean, Ellen wasn't a writer, but she was a reader and a thinker and a sharer and a lover of words, from, you know, poetry to novels to how-to books, and she chose a lot of the books in our library and recommended them to people in our community, and in that way, really had a tremendous influence over our lives.
Yeah, boy, you talk about community, somebody that is really, that's what they're doing, is making connections.
Yeah, yeah, and she, I think, you know, one of my best stories about that obituary comes from, a while back, remember when, you know, Ted Kaczynski and the Unabomber his manifesto was out, the editor of the Chilkat Valley News, Tom Morford, wanted a copy of it, you know, just out of curiosity to see what the heck was in it. And so he went, of course, to the library, and he asked Ellen if the library had one. And she said, no, but I know where you can get one.
Yeah, good for her.
And she gave his phone number to someone in town who she knew had a copy of it, so he got to look at it. And,
oh, wow.
I mean, and that's, you know, that's sort of community in action, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of libraries won't circulate the Anarchist Cookbook for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at least she told you where to get it. I'm loving it. We're talking with Heather Lendy. She is the author of Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs and a columnist for Woman's Day. And, oh, my heavens, on and on. Okay, third guest, Bruce Farnsworth. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Bruce is a poet, a published poet, and geez, I don't even know what to say about you, Bruce. Recently, he's been very involved with an art center in Mountain View. And are we at the end of that adventure, Bruce?
Well, I am. I can't really speak for the other members of the board of the nonprofit that's been sort of spearheading that effort to create an art center in Mountain View. They, you know, they haven't really, I don't think, made a complete determination whether or not it's obituary time. But yeah, I think so. I mean, I got involved in that and
how many years has it been?
Oh, seven.
Oh, my.
7 long years.
All right. And we had, out of that, we had
this. That's a
lyric. Yeah. Out of that, we had the MTS Gallery, which MTS, I think, stood for something like Mountain View Trailer Supply.
No, it didn't really stand for anything. No, I'm really. People ask that all the time. What does MTS stand for? And it doesn't stand for anything. And that shouldn't be too hard. Yeah, it's just 3 letters, and it shouldn't be. They look good. They're very blocky and graphic. They work as a, you know, a button or a letterhead very well.
It's abstract, man.
I mean, people, nobody knows what STP stands for, but when you see it on the side of a race car, you don't, you know, you don't sit there and go, gosh, I wonder what that's, you know, you just know.
I do. Yeah.
You do?
I'm a nerd, though.
Okay, I don't want to know, but...
No. Stone Temple Pilots, duh.
Ah.
Excellent. That is what it stands for. I had no idea. They've been into NASCAR for so long.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage of 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. We got artists in the building and on the telephone here. And I don't really quite know where it's going to go, but Bruce, I wanted you to talk a little bit about the effort of trying to make this thing happen in a kind of an intractable neighborhood.
I think it's reasonable to declare that we failed to in really our ultimate objective. We wanted to make a big art center, and we felt like the community was ready for it. A city of this size, if you look around most states and come across cities that are pushing 300,000 or so residents, there's usually some kind of a large scale place where artists from one or more disciplines gather, make art, present art, build community. And Anchorage hasn't had anything like that since an experiment in that back in the 70s, the Visual Arts Center that I know a lot of people not only remember, but a lot of people really benefited from the existence of that. And it was a victim of some bad business planning and some economic, vagaries that I think also, strangely enough, were part of the problem that we had. The recent economic meltdown certainly didn't help our cause, but really the neighborhood, the Mountain View neighborhood, where we kind of put down our flag, wasn't the problem. It really wasn't. I don't think it had anything to do with it. In fact, it was really more that. Kind of a set of I guess you would say variables all conspired to just make it so that it wasn't the time. And this conversation is not over. I mean, there will be at some point a multidisciplinary art center in this community. Probably it'll look a lot like the one that we've been envisioning. But
yeah, I think that we have an artists here, visual, literary, musical, theatrical, on an unreal scale for a community of this size. I think we have people who can compete at the national level across every discipline. And I, especially after traveling to so many other cities pushing 300,000 and seeing what we all have to offer, Anchorage has an incredible array. I can't speak as much to the rest of the state, but I hear very good evidence that that's true all across Alaska.
They're just writers galore.
Oh yeah, we got tons of writers. We have one of the finest living composers lives in Alaska. We have just people you wouldn't expect, I think, who've decided to make this their home. But we have such a trouble with venues I know musicians are feeling the crunch with venues too right now. We've been there's a new kind of Alaska music partnership starting up. It's mostly among like rock and punk bands right now. I'm trying to represent the acoustic side of things. We've got and it's hard to get everybody organized because you got a bunch of working musicians. That's definitely a herding cats proposition. But what everyone can agree on is venue space is really the trouble, and every visual artist I talk to is having the same issue. We have the people, we have the talent, we need the space, and I think that we have the audience too. I think we have a community that would like to be out more, but we don't quite have the culture of going out. We don't have quite the structures for going out on a regular basis like other cities have.
Maybe the answer is to go commercial more somehow. I mean, it isn't part of the problem. I mean, for instance, you take the old Visual Arts Center in Anchorage, the real problem there was the overhead. It was too much money. It was too much money. You just couldn't pull that money in. There was no machinery for pulling the money in. They had a gallery there, but that didn't do much business at all. And, they would try and do events. It would be fundraisers sometimes, more or less. But overall, you know, every month having to put out those checks is damn hard. And, there's a stage of maturity where you just have to say, okay, maybe we got to charge. I mean, maybe if people value it, they have to pay for it.
That's kind of like NPR, isn't it?
Well, whatever.
Hey, I actually base my whole financial model on the NPR model, probably because I spent so many years volunteering.
Boy, are you in trouble.
Boy, am I in trouble. Well, but the proposal being that instead of charging people at the door, instead of setting up effectively a paywall, half my mission is educating people that if they don't pay, the art goes away, because it does. And the other half is putting out a product good enough that people are, in fact, inspired to give money. And almost every artist I know has a little bit of an allergy to talking about or asking for money. And that's probably fair, because that's putting a value on something that you don't want to put a value on. It feels yucky too. We don't like to talk about it. Even visual artists don't like to share information with each other about how they price things, or tell one another what to price things. Musicians, the question all across music right now is how to monetize what you're doing. And I sometimes feel like I come across as crass or as being too willing to monetize things. And for that, I do sometimes want to apologize, but at the same time, I want to make a full-time living, and I'm the daughter of starving artists, and I'm not doing that again. I believe art is worth money. I really do.
Two generations is too much.
Break the cycle.
Well, but I also think that when my audiences are not upset by paying money, they like to when the product is good. They're excited to. But creating the structures for the money to flow correctly and for the request to be made and for the funds to come in sort of a smooth cycle that ensures longevity, that's really hard to do.
Well, Heather, we're kind of leaving you out of the conversation for a moment, but I want to bring you back in. The State Council on the Arts has just released a study of Alaska's Creative Vitality Index, and it shows that we're more creatively vital than Oregon. I mean,
well, of course.
Who knew?
That doesn't surprise me, really. I mean, here in Haines, we love to say that we have more than this or that per capita than any other town in the world. But I do know that
both
we have a really high number of artists, visual artists, musicians. Not so many writers, but a budding group of people that are interested in writing, I think.
And I think if you go statewide,
you know, on their tax returns that they're an artist, and that, I think there's a reason. I mean, I think it's because when you live in an inspiring place physically, you know, when some place is just so beautiful, it does tend to, spur creativity. And I also think because our communities are so diverse, at least, and maybe this is true of Anchorage too, I'm not that familiar with it, but certainly like Haines, the people that come and go are inspiring, and sort of rubbing your shoulders up against them makes you more creative, and it changes the dialogue even cynically, I think. And hearing you all talk about Anchorage is interesting, because in our town, you know, we've got 2,400 people, but we have a performing arts center, and, you know, we have a museum, and we have a library, and we have venues for art and artists, and those are public.
Yeah. What the Vitality Index shows is that, you know, it uses the metrics you might expect, so what the arts generates in the larger sense, but also what do people actually do for a living? And it turns out that in Alaska, we do, statewide, have way more than our share of writers and way more than our share of architects. And either one of these, when you think about it, is obvious.
But well, I think, too, though, I think the other part of this discussion that can't go, I mean, that really should be sort of tossed in here is the value of having, a banker like Elmer Rasmussen come in with the Rasmussen Foundation and give individual art awards. I mean, that's huge, I think.
Oh,
and
yeah.
that may have changed the perception of the value of art in Alaska and the value of someone staying at home and writing a poem instead of, you know, driving a tour bus or going fishing or whatever. And to say that those endeavors are worth $25,000 a year or whatever. I mean, look at what just happened with Ray Troll down in Ketchikan, I mean, at Guggenheim, for a guy that draws fish.
You're right.
I mean, that's great, you know, and I think that heightened, and people start to think, gee, you know, maybe Alaska's art is worth something, and maybe fostering our arts community is important to us as a state and as a people.
Yeah, well, I think, all four of us here, with background in the arts of one way or another, are all going to be all in favor of artists having a better reputation in the community and being valued more. I think that's pretty clear. But I think it's getting from here to there. And I would agree with you, Heather, that the arts fellowships are an important thing because essentially it liberates the artist for a certain period of time to actually go towards the creation of a product. And when you get a product, you know, every artist that I know of has to have a deadline in order to get the product. And when you take the money, you actually have to get a result. And many of our creators are part-time. There are very few full-time artists in the entire state. And so they need that.
I think the discussion too, though, isn't always about I know it's the money part's important, but I know, like here in small towns, things like community theater, choirs, school music programs, I mean, and art programs, those are the kind of things that kind of build a little underpinning that do what you were talking about in the beginning of the show, build communities away from, you know, the Facebook communities, but real communities. I mean, singing in a choir with a bunch of diverse people makes something very different than just the music that you're singing, you know?
Absolutely.
Are you saying my 700 Facebook friends aren't my real friends?
Well, I'm not.
I'm just kidding because I'm not actually on Facebook.
I know you're not.
I know you're not. That's what I'm saying.
Some people just won't.
Well, can I say one thing about the Rasmussen Foundation? Because I think that's what both Heather and you, Steve, were referring to, and it's an amazing thing. I mean, we're just a little over halfway through a 10-year sort of trial period, a 10-year arts initiative, which is what the Rasmussen Foundation calls it, and they constructed it to do a number of things, and I think it's really, really changed a lot. I agree with you, Heather. Making individual artists eligible to receive grants and funding directly from a philanthropic foundation like the Rasmussen Foundation was just a major change. I mean, everything else in the past has gone from corporations or philanthropists to 501c3 nonprofit corporations. And the individual artists were supposed to benefit by that sort of through the trickle-down effect of it. And here's a way to get money directly into, you know, investing in real creativity, not in organizational. And I don't have anything against arts organizations. I founded one 7 years ago, but I'm just saying this is an amazing game-changing thing. Problem is, it's the only one of its kind in the state. And I think if you look around, and that's another thing about Alaska that's unique, is our really, really shallow pool of philanthropic funding. I mean, there's just Rasmussen Foundation's doing a great job, but they cannot do everything, and I know they know that well. And they, I'm sure they wish that there were three or four sort of sister foundations that they could partner with here in the state to accomplish some of their objectives. But there we are.
I would certainly think so. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. And yeah, we got a call. We got an email. When I was doing the promo for this, I put it in terms of, you know, the movie business is can't get enough of Alaska now, and that is going to change how Alaska is perceived. Maybe we need to think about how we are constructing our own image. It might be a little different from what they. You know.
That's a great topic.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I loved traveling this year. The you know, everywhere I went, every single day that I was on the road, I played 133 shows, and I was traveling for 9 months. And every day I was meeting a new group of people, and every day they had questions about Alaska. And every day their questions were based on two things, Sarah Palin and Alaska reality TV. And, you know, and it was... It was fun to have a chance to speak up, not as a, you know, I'm not a lifelong Alaskan. I defer to the many people who've lived here a lot longer than me. But to even just, you know, dispel a few of the ideas or to reorient a few of the ideas about how things are different, both from what they see on TV, and we are not defined by those few small most, you know, we're not defined by those things. And I don't know, just that there's so many things about life up here that would surprise
people
outside. And having a chance to say those things directly was, I think, as much fun as any other part of the trip.
Yeah, I can think of like...
And lying to them occasionally when it's fun.
Of course.
Long tradition of hoodwinking the tourists.
Oh, yes. But, come see the penguins.
But you just, there's things that are inexpressible, and yet I think artists have to continue to reach for ways to express them, and they had... Just some of them that just pop into mind is the light.
Mm-hmm.
Every visual artist I know grapples with the light of Alaska. Any visual artist that comes into Alaska is utterly floored and stunned by the different kind of light we have here. Mm-hmm. The seasonality, berry picking. How can you tell somebody about what it really is like when the berries are really ripe and they're everywhere and you absolutely have to be out there? That is a very, very subtle thing to try and find an expression for that would carry in Iowa.
I'm deeply, deeply hopeful that the film industry, if we have to, you know, accommodate an industry of that size and that sort of, and that, I guess the outside nature defining what happens here, I would hope that the infrastructure that comes up and the people that come up will empower people who are already here to tell their own story as well. We have a ton of filmmakers here already who could definitely benefit from the funding, the experience, the exposure, the connections, the space. I mean, there's a soundstage now in Palmer, right? It just opened,
well,
I hear this.
An attempted soundstage, anyway.
An attempted soundstage.
Yeah.
One of my friends saw it last week and was pretty impressed. And
great.
But, you know, if we have people coming up here and meeting one another, I know there's been a ton of interest. And that may facilitate artists working here to take back the message, you know.
Yeah. When the Whale movie was here, you know, it was sort of... those people...
Those
infected,
people
infected the community. No, I'm not in a bad way. Mm-hmm. I don't know of too many people that had. Well, I do know one person negative, mm-hmm. But they were a working crew and they were badly exploited. But
well, there were a lot of imaginations that were fired up by the possibility of doing a major movie right here with what we have here.
But all they had to go to the local restaurants and explore the local scene and whatnot. And these are people that are going to go back to, you know, Hollywood and Santa Monica and so forth, and talk about the stuff that they saw and the stuff that they experienced. And they'll
long for breakfast at Snow City again.
Of course they will. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by the Association of Alaska School Boards, AASB, believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org.
I'm thinking of a couple of towns that I've visited on the Appalachian Trail. One of them was White River Junction, New Hampshire. And there's
hey, I was just there.
Yeah. It's like one time a railroad. It's right on the river. It's part of three towns, you know, really, including Hanover and Lebanon. There's a little regional airport that the airplanes hop back and forth between Boston and there. And highways run right through there along with the big river. And used to be a railroad hub, hardly any railroad happening there anymore, and it's gone all over to arts. There's a whole vital art scene going on at White River Junction. They have this school that teaches graphic comics, making comics, a school for making comics. It has theater, has restaurants, cafes, boutiques, and all that. All right, take another one. Harper's Ferry. It's a national park. It's a confluence of rivers. It is the headquarters for the Appalachian Trail Commission. All the records and so forth of all the little journals that are filled out and all the shelters, the trail are housed there. And it has this sort of national park. And, of course, it's a very important place historically. It's really where the first terrorist attack happened long ago and before the Civil War. And there ain't a decent place to eat in that whole town. It has no cultural mass. It just the national park doesn't do the job. And
well,
so
well,
you know, do you want to go out to eat? You have to go to Applebee's or something.
Interesting,
a fabricated
interesting example
culture
to compare those two places. And I would say that if you really went in and took a close look at like why, you know, here are these two towns that have a lot in common, very, you know, many similarities. And I think what you would find the difference is leadership.
Absolutely.
You would find that there's some kind of visionary leadership in the town that has kind of put its eggs in the arts basket. And I feel like, I mean, we've done a lot of, in the first half of the show, we've done a lot of celebrating of the artists and the amount of creativity that exists here. And I wouldn't argue with that at all. I think this is an amazing place, Alaska, the whole state. People come up here and especially creative people come up here and visit and they want to live here. And that's why we have so many artists and writers. And that. But what we don't have is a culture, a tradition of fostering that and really using it to the advantage of the state. We're making, I think it's really unfortunate. And I'm not sure how we're going to solve the problem. I'm not sure how we're going to assess the real difficulties that it presents us as we move forward and you know, when we try to think of how we're going to diversify our economy and things like that. You know, I mean, as long as we're able and to sustain our lifestyle on the basis of oil, I think we don't really need to address this, but I think everybody agrees. I mean, we hear everybody saying, you know, we got to diversify the economy in the long run, but the arts is a big part of that, and the arts is a big part of just problem solving in a society in general.
Well, I think also it has to do with the real estate market. we've seen it over and over again, and that's certainly part of what they were trying to do in Mountain View was to gentrify it, to bring in the arts and the malls and so forth, and try and make it a desirable place for people to live. And the jury's still out on that, I think, you know. But as time goes on, it is likely just because of gas mileage, it will become more of a vibrant residential area. But over and over again, we've seen that artists are the first to move into areas, to troubled neighborhoods, because the rents are cheap, and get something going, and then it becomes a cool place to go, and so forth. I think that's part of what happened White River Junction. What do you think, Marion Call?
I think there are two forces at work there. I think one is that the artists move in and they'll take advantage of whatever space they can. You go to the kind of artsy neighborhoods in town that maybe, you know, slightly maybe lower income, maybe kind of older housing, and the artists have made the best of whatever they have. They've turned garages into workshops. They've made their yards incredible spaces. They have house parties where they do. I mean, just the kind of house-based scene is really exciting. And as a neighborhood gets a higher and higher saturation of artists and, say, young professionals, too, who have the education but not the money yet, maybe, or are still paying off the debt, I don't want to say they attract certain businesses, and they attract some businesses that are very grassroots, community-based, small business, the kind of stuff that you want in your neighborhood, regardless of income level of the surrounding neighborhood. And then they attract, like Mountain View did, right in view of the art center, the most enormous strip mall I've ever seen, which always has an empty parking lot, which is just kind of, because frankly, who wants to go there? There's another one right across town that's identical. Who cares? I mean, that's not gentrification. That's like these two very different forces in like sharing space. And I thought it was just a studying contrast to have the art centers and sort of the stuff that was happening on Mountain View Drive, from Noble's Diner to sort of the small businesses that were starting to develop along there, or community organizations, and then have the biggest strip mall come and just obliterate, you know, a couple square miles of that area. And I haven't seen
green,
that part
of green space.
Yeah, it was green space, and I haven't seen that flourishing. No one's shopping there.
Yeah.
Because frankly, that's not what we want our community to look like. We want our community to look like the small businesses, and that's not a rich poor thing. That's everyone. We want to define our community by the small businesses and the small organizations in it.
Yeah.
But the question is then, do we go shop? Do we go attend? Do we show up to the events? Do we support these organizations? That's, I think, what Bruce is saying. We have the creativity. We have the number of small businesses and restaurants and arts projects starting here in any given year is incredible. But does the community turn out? And we need to get the community to turn out. That's a possible thing, but it's going to take a lot of work to change the culture.
Heather Lindy, do you think Haines is hanging on to its small townness, its identity? The people like to go to the local joint to hang out, and it's not an Applebee's or a McDonald's or.
We don't have anything like that here, and I think what's
lucky.
Unique about Haines is that we have, I mean, not anything like an Applebee's or McDonald's, but we certainly have a thriving community, and I think that's from, you know, our isolation in part, and also an attitude of people here to, you know, really do support things like the Haines Arts Council and, you know, the kids' theater camp in the summer, or public radio, or all those kind of things are pretty important to our community, and I think it's a little different than, you know, the Anchorage discussion, because, you know, Anchorage is a relatively new city, and a lot of the artists are kind of newcomers. And here, you know, at least in the Choquette Valley, because there's been a lot of food and it's been a nice place to live, the Tlingit, the native people, have been creating art here, you know, for 6,000 years. And so it's almost like infused in the air around here, I think, on some level. And that art has helped, I think, to hold the culture together. You know, the music, the visual arts, the stories, all of it. And so it's, you know, I guess if I was, the one thing, of course, we could use here, like everywhere, is that leadership that says, hey, you know, why aren't we capitalizing a little more on this? Why aren't we using our tourism dollars to promote our artists instead of, you know, just our raft trips. Not that the raft trips aren't great, but to emphasize that whole, you know, artistic culture that's here a little more. And I think that's one way, because the state seems to spend money on, you know, tourism marketing, and I think a lot of the art can be, you know, certainly linked to that, especially with festivals and that sort of thing. I mean,
yeah.
You look at the Folk Festival in Juneau or our state fair here in Haines, you know, those kind of things.
Well, you know, I guess the ferry run there is one of the most profitable, if not the most profitable, that the state has. If you can talk about profitable in terms of the ferry runs, it's problematical sometimes to fly to Haines, but of course you can drive there, and I guess you can drive there year round. Although sometimes the pass is a little bit of a problem, right?
Mm-hmm. But you can do it, you know.
But you're driving there for, we must add, you're driving there from nowhere. Whitehorse, oh yeah.
Well, there's a lot of culture up there, though, too. I mean, you could take a cue from the Canadians, and we're very close to Skagway to there, and they really emphasize, you know, their I know they're musicians, and they're, you know, the Frostbite Festival, and they're singers and songwriters and visual artists and everything. I mean, they're tremendously supportive of that, and recognize that in the north, particularly, that culture is, you know, on lots of levels, it's the you know, antidote to the darker side of living in the north.
You know, suddenly
find creativity. Yeah. They might not dive into, you know, the despair of alcoholism or drug abuse or, you know, domestic violence, all that other stuff.
Yeah.
It's the flip side of that, and I think some governments anyway realize that that's really important.
Well, there's certainly no end of people that do crafts in Alaska. And, you know, I can't help it. Anytime in the summer in Anchorage, and I'm sure it's going to be worse than ever this year, you go downtown, it is full of people that got off of cruise ships, and they have these sort of predatory T-shirt shops everywhere that are, you know, I mean, not all of them are bad, but quite a few of them are bad. They're only open in the summer, and they're not really... People are not really buying a real taste of Alaska there. First off, they might not anyway because it would cost too much. But nonetheless, it would be good if there were some that were, and there are some, that were outlets for crafts that people are more than happy to be making.
I think your smarter tourists can tell the difference, but the notion would be that Anchorage ought to deliberately develop in such a way that we attract the smarter tourists, because the smarter tourists are going to be dropping more dollars actually in our community and not dollars that are just going to be outsourced to wherever that stuff comes from. China, most of it on the bottom, if you look at it. Nothing against China, but we need those tourism dollars here. And if the city and the rest of the state, too, decides to deliberately develop in such a way that the arts dollars are actually being distributed in our community, that's economically smart. And it gives the tourists a deeper, better experience of what things are available here.
Let's go to Caroline, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome back to the show, Caroline.
Yes, good morning. I've been collecting art up here since 7 years after I got here, because I couldn't afford it before then. But once I got settled in, I was blown away by the quality of the Alaskan artists. And one suggestion I have, I think your guest made a great statement, and it could even make a good bumper sticker, art, if you don't pay, it doesn't stay. But what I have suggested to some rural artists is that they might consider a web page. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we had a massive statewide web page that people could pay a percentage and to join? And I'm thinking of doing little profiles on people like Bill Ray, whose work is tremendous. He's been in Germany for many years, I'd say 25 years, and a successful artist. To get some of these artists, like, all the visual artists, there was a fellow named Anderson, and I lusted after one of his pieces I couldn't afford, and the museum bought it. And we have some homegrown artists who have massive museum pieces like Jim Belke. But to get profiles of some of these folks that have made it outside, as it were, and, you know, not just the visual arts, but Molly Smith's another one. Because people, I heard a long time ago that people will value the kitten they got for a buck over the one they got for free. And people like to know that they are on the bandwagon of success. And I think one of the things that we always see with the perception of people in art is that they've always got their hand out. It's either they got to have a Rasmussen grant, or they got to have this, or they got to have that. And I think there would be a huge benefit to us showing the successful artists, the ones that came here and went back out and made their chops here and went back out, or those that were born and raised here and reflect success.
You know, so, it could be somebody's already doing that. In fact,
sure
they probably are.
So. I sure hope so. But anyway, that was just the idea of promoting or at least spotlighting the artists who have been highly successful in the outside world.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Caroline.
Bye.
Email from Don Reardon, who we will have to say is a screenwriter and has a screenplay. And says with regard...
Novel, too.
With regards to Hollywood coming to Alaska, one thing that has to happen is that Alaska artists and writers need to find a way to get access to Hollywood agents and producers so that our stories have a chance. I'm loving it. No, go ahead. Give us the other sound effect now.
What? No, that was an alarm clock. That's when I normally wake up. You got me here pretty early.
We got to hear your rain stick, though.
Oh, sorry. I brought my rain stick just in case. So...
But I
play it like a shaker, though.
Yeah, I know you do.
Speaking of Don Reardon, though, by the way, he's an example of someone that, like Caroline, I think, was just talking about. I mean, he is a born and raised Alaskan, and his recently published novel is getting all kinds of attention, both in state and out of state, and yeah, those are the people that really inspire the rest of us to say, okay, maybe I don't have to move. Maybe I really can live here, because I agree with something Marion said much earlier in the show, which is we want to live here because this is a great place to live. And the trick is to find a formula that allows artists to stay here and still participate in the mainstream of their practice and foster peer-to-peer relationships with other artists around the world who are doing similar things without having to go, all to one place. And that's possible. Don is a great example of that kind of thing.
You know, he was basically saying that it would be good if the state acted as some kind of a broker for this. And I think there is a possibility of, they did renew the tax credits now.
Yeah, we haven't come out and really addressed it in this program so far, but I mean, I really think that if you talk to people who really think about this issue a lot, and it's a hard thing to talk about because people find the subject difficult, but there needs to be a greater in conscious public investment in fostering the arts, and that really means in fostering artists and investing in them and their work. And we just, as a state, and as I don't know what it's like in Haines, it might be a little bit different, but in Anchorage and the other parts of the state that I'm familiar with, it's just not happening, and it's not happening nearly to the extent. In fact, it's really a fairly terrible situation.
When we did a show on the motion picture industry around the time of the film festival here, we discovered that one of the things that happened and one of the reasons that there's so much fascination with Alaska is because there's not enough money to do the full screenplay Hollywood production anymore, and they're all trying to do it cheap. And you wouldn't think of Alaska as being cheap, but with the tax credit and everything, it's cheaper than trying to do a feature film.
And one of the funny things that happened with the Film Initiative is they created a film office, and a bunch of local filmmakers and people working in film got together and read over their mission statement and realized that the film office's entire mission statement was based on facilitating filmmakers from outside. There was not a single word about Alaskan filmmakers or Alaskan film. So hopefully that is going to evolve.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook.
Marion Call, I want to go back to this, something that you said at the TEDx talks that we had here recently, and I think you actually had to kick them off, didn't you? Were you number one talker there at the...
Yeah, I was the beginning of the day, and I was a little sleepy.
The icebreaker, yeah.
I ran out of time.
But yeah, you did. You totally overran your time, and I still want to hear the end of your talk. But
I didn't even get to the second half. In fact, someone took away the opposite from my original point. Maybe I'll make a YouTube video of my talk as it was supposed to be. But
yeah. But you that is terrible. You know, you got to tighten up your writing.
I was. It was early in the morning for a musician. You got to appreciate.
Well, but you said something that definitely stuck with me, and then I passed on to Bruce, and I pass on every chance I get. You said, you know, if you got something cool, it's probably there because somebody fought to have it there. And if there's something onerous that you don't have in your community, it's probably not there because somebody fought real hard not to have it there.
That's right. I was part of a fight to keep Walmart out of my community when I was young. I lived in Gig Harbor, Washington, and we had a long, drawn-out fight.
I can't even imagine. That's the
Walmart.
Worst possible place for a Walmart.
Well, yeah, and we fought it for years, and it took a lot of concentrated effort, community protests, every such thing. And we kept them out because they had a stated goal in Washington State of a Walmart every 20 or 30 miles or something. It was insane. And we did not want them. And so we fought and kept them out. And then 3 years later, the organization, I forget how many years later, I might be making that up. The organization, the Peninsula Neighborhood Association that did community planning for Gig Harbor dissolved or lost. They disappeared. I don't know why. I was too young to understand. And within a year, we had Target and every other thing in right under our noses. And Gig Harbor is no longer recognizable as the community I grew up in. I still love it dearly, but it is nothing like the community I remember growing up in. And it's because people stopped fighting.
You never hear of anybody with a business plan that calls for an art center every 100 miles.
What a concept. No, you do. It's just in Canada and Europe. It's not here.
Let's go down to Homer, the end of the road. And Andrea, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks. I just want to say thank you for doing this show. And I write a column for the Homer News here and make my little $40 a month from that, and recently went into a public assistance office. I'm a mother of three, and the person helping me with my Denali KidCare application said, well, it's low income, but you'll be a better artist for it. And I think there's that notion that there's like the romance of poverty will make our art better. And I just looked at her and I said, actually, resources would really help me write more, not poverty. So I think there's that kind of age-old idea that if we're poor, we'll be better artists, and it's just not true. So thanks for doing the show today.
All right. Yeah, thank you. I think that people don't realize probably the work ethic of artists. In order to create, if you have this, you absolutely have to create. It sort of also demands probably a more physical effort and more persistence than the average person would imagine. It's not just exactly hanging out and being a bohemian all the time, although hopefully you get some of that in too.
There are so many really mistaken stereotypes about artists. I think in the popular mind, I think when, you know, if people are asked to like, okay, describe an artist, and I think you'd really get a lot of people who would give you this picture of a somebody all dressed in black, sitting smoking clove cigarettes, drinking room temperature vermouth in the coffee shop, reading the French existentialist novel all day, right?
Okay, but now there's a Russian arts group. I don't know if you heard about this, but their name is War, and they just won a prize for this piece of public art they did, and they tend to be very confrontational pieces of art. And this one in particular was, because they took a drawbridge and made it into a giant penis. and they got an award for that. And it's wondered why.
What's your point, Steve?
My point is that, well, regardless of the merit of the art or whether it's confrontational or not, I think there is a great deal of public perception that artists are just laughing at people.
Yeah, and that's what I was getting at. I mean, the real artists that I know, and I know a lot of artists, I a lot of visual artists, a lot of people in a lot of different disciplines, and one of the things about them is that they're small business entrepreneurs. almost every single one of them. That's what art is in our country, in our society. Art is a small business, and it's either a successful small business or it's a marginal and not so successful small business, but people are hustling. They're trying to earn a dollar, and when they do earn a dollar, they plow it back into the economy in some way or another, often by hiring other artists when they need help on projects, on business consultation, whatever it is.
Yeah, but still, you're a poet. You know that, what is your job? You're defined the itch in the culture, which they has plenty right now.
Well, poets are a bad example because...
And find a way to scratch it. No, I'm serious. It's Poetry Month. Now, think about it.
It's Poetry Month. You know, that you're right, Poetry Month. That just tells you how unappreciated and and absolutely unvalued poets are because they have a month named after them. I mean, look at the other months. Just the 2 months preceding Poetry Month, what are they? Black History Month? And Women's History Month. And then you got Poetry Month. And just by taking a look at all of the, whoever has a month named after them, that's who really nobody cares about.
Oh, God. Oh, you're cruel.
You cynic, you.
It's true. Why would you have to name a month after them? You don't have a, you don't have a banker's month or a stockbroker's month because they have love all the time, every month.
I do want to say before we run out of time that I think you're right. The perception of artists as sitting around all day or as taking money to do nothing. Every artist I know, including writers, they'll get funds of some kind. They'll earn them, or they'll get a grant, or they'll what have you, and they will immediately be spending most of that money again on their art, one way or another, or on mere subsistence. A lot of money comes through my bank accounts, but all of it goes back out again. I'm still living on ramen because it all goes out to pay other local musicians, to pay recording engineers, to pay print shops, to pay, all the services that I have to purchase in the course of a business. Go out to other, worthy organizations, hopefully, and local restaurants and the local scene.
Okay, I wanna get around to the to the plugs here. And Heather, we'll start with you. You're working on a novel, Heather Lendy. What is it? When are we gonna see it?
I don't know when we're gonna see it or not. I'm working on it through my, and I'll give a plug, I guess, because I am doing this novel now, and I'm getting my master's, as my husband says, in make-believe fiction.
Excellent.
And I'll give a plug for the low residency MFA at UAA, if anybody is interested in maybe, I don't know, listening to you guys, they might not want to explore their artistic side if they're going to starve, but it's a great program for poets and for nonfiction writers and for people like me who were a working nonfiction writer to become a fiction writer.
So. Well, I really love the public readings that they do.
I'll give a plug for them.
I wish they would publicize them more. Marion Call, you've got a thing coming up at the Snow Goose, and it's poetry, it's spoken and song, right?
Yeah, that's right. We've got we're trying to get a bunch of the acoustic musicians and some poets together on one big event. It's going to be a big celebration. It's going to be really fun. We did one last year, and people loved it so much. They said, do it again. It's a showcase. It's all local, and it's called Acoustic North at the Snow Goose. You can get tickets at my website, marioncall.com. And my only other solo show this month will be at Vagabond Blues in Palmer on Thursday. Great venue.
Well, but I just want to get more like what actually happens at the Snow Goose.
What actually happens? Yeah. All these singer-songwriters and instrumentalists, locally really well-known established folks, are going to be coming in on one another's songs and presenting just a glorious showcase of music. And we're going to have several poets and storytelling as well. Mike Burwell, UAA faculty. We got Kima Hamilton and Karina Delgado. Great people. So.
Thanks, Bruce. We don't have time for your plug, but I don't think you have one anyway.
May 21st, we're celebrating. We're giving ourselves a huge goodbye party.
Woo-hoo. All right.
Put it on your calendar.
I'm Steve Eimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough.
Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.